Members, I'm going to call the meeting to order unofficially. We don't quite have a quorum. Representative Howe, welcome to the testifying table. We aren't official yet, so we can't move your bill yet, but we could begin the discussion. Members, this is House File 704. It's a concurrent enrollment course requirement bill. And so why don't you, Representative Howe, introduce yourself for the record and then explain the policy that's included in 704.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm Representative Jeff Howe. The changes for this statute here in House File 704, basically it's what a lot of folks already assume happens with concurrent enrollment. It's very simple. It says a course offered under this subdivision must use the same syllabus, final exam, and grading scale as the equivalent course offered at the eligible public post-secondary system or an eligible private post-secondary institution. And basically, folks, members, everybody already believes that if you're getting concurrent enrollment and you're getting credit at a post-secondary institution, that you're already taking the same exam or final exam that you would have taken if you did the PSEO program and actually went to the college for the course. That is not the case. There's no requirement for that to happen. And you could take a totally separate, different final exam. You could be going off a totally separate course outline or syllabus. So there's really no correlation between the grade that you get compared to the grade that you would have gotten at the college if you went to PSEO, and there's no correlation to the final exam or the course content between the college and the if you took it at the high school as concurrent enrollment.
Representative Howe, you have some testifiers. Would they join us at the table?
Yes. I have Professor John Palmer.
And members, I can officially call the meeting to order. We now have a quorum. And Representative Peterson, would you move the minutes, please?
Madam Chair, thank you. I'd like to move the minutes.
Representative Peterson moves the minutes from March 19. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Welcome to our committee, sir, and please say your name for the record.
Yes.
And I will move, before we proceed, House File 704 to be referred to the Committee on Higher Education. Please proceed.
Madam Chairman and members, my name is John Palmer. I'm soon to be Professor Emeriti. 39 years of employment at St. Cloud State is going to end in employment in 37 days, at which time I will no longer be a State of Minnesota employee. I'm currently on phased retirement. My wife asked me, why are you getting up at 5:30 in the morning to come to a committee hearing at 8:15? And it doesn't have anything to do with traffic safety education.
That's right. That's your specialty.
That's
I know
my
that.
Specialty.
Please proceed.
This is an opportunity for a citizen to come forward and talk about an issue that's come to my attention as a result of the work that I've done. PSEO is a program that Minnesota has led the country in. PSEO has grown beyond anyone's wildest imagination or dream. One of the things that's come to my attention is a disconnect that can occur as a result of the way in which we deliver something called concurrent instruction. The disconnect happens, I do not think, in any malicious or intentional way, but it just happens. Words have meaning. To most of you, a syllabus would be something you would understand as not being intellectual property. Syllabus is used in this bill is not used in the same way as a Minsky and the IFO have discussed its meaning. It's meant to mean that that which is taught will be the same content, that which is assessed would be assessed in a similar way, so that the student that takes the course receives a comparable experience in regards to content and assessment. It's come to my attention that that is not always the case, and with the rapid growth in concurrent instruction that has occurred, I believe that Representative Howe's bill is a good step to point out a need that ordinary people would expect to be the case, that if I take English literature, it's English literature that includes the same content as an on-campus class as one that would be conducted off-campus. Just as a point of information, our concurrent instruction in the state of Minnesota has grown to the point that it is the second largest public university. There were over 18,000 FYEs generated through all forms of post-secondary options that were delivered last year in the state of Minnesota, which does make it the second largest compilation of credits, and that's why I refer to it as a university. It is diffuse in how it is managed. This bill would create some uniformity in one element of how it would be managed.
Thank you, Mr. Palmer. And Representative Howe, any other testifiers with support of your provision?
I did not bring any other testifiers.
Then we'll hear from those with concerns. Please come forward. Thank you, Mr. Palmer. Please stick around because there may be questions.
Thank you.
Welcome to our committee, Ms. Sebastian and Dr. Hagelin.
Thank you.
Are we going to begin with you, Ms. Sebastian? Please introduce yourself for the record and begin.
All right. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Just make sure the microphone is in place for her. Thank you.
My name is Kay Sebastian, and I am the director of the Senior to Sophomore Program at St. Cloud State University. That is our concurrent enrollment program. The program has been around for 19 years. I've been the director for 17 of those years. We have had significant growth over those years, and we are very pleased that we are able to offer the opportunity that the PSEO legislation has given our students in our state, the opportunity for qualified students to earn college credit while they're in high school. We take quality and rigor very seriously, and we have a variety of ways that we work to assure ourselves that the quality is comparable to that on our campus. We are NASEP approved, and NASEP has a very rigorous accreditation process that talks a lot about making sure that the learning objectives of the course are the same, the content is the same, the assessment practices are the same. That doesn't mean they are the exact same syllabus exists or that the same activities are done. They aren't done like that on campus in most cases, that, you know, one physics class is not necessarily the same as the next of the same number. But the quality is the same, and our faculty take great care in working with each high school instructor to ensure that that's happened. We pair each high school instructor with an individual faculty member, and they work with them and approve their syllabus, their tests, their textbook, everything about the course each year. So that's part of our process. So we approve people in a careful way. We give them orientation and training. We give them ongoing support. And we do assessments that are designed by the department faculty in conjunction with their high school counterpart. So we feel very strongly that we have a real sound program. Many of our departments, not all, many have chosen to do before and after tests. When they do before and after tests in their senior to sophomore classes and on campus, they almost always find that the senior and sophomore classes score higher on those before and after tests. We had one case a number of years ago when that was not the case. The faculty spoke with the principal of the high school that was involved. They switched faculty teachers in the high school, and after that, the assessment showed that the learning was, you know, in line and with what they were expecting from the senior and sophomore courses. So when there are problems, we address them and make the changes necessary. I have with me Dr. Kevin Haglund, who is the chair of our physics and astronomy class and also a senior to sophomore partner.
Welcome to our committee, Dr. Haglund, and please say your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kevin Haglund, professor and chairperson in physics and astronomy at St. Cloud State University. I have been involved with concurrent enrollment for several years, and I've seen the sort of the positive impact it has on these high school learners as they transition from their current environment into university environment. We take in physics, we take steps to ensure consistency, not only across our university courses, but the courses that are concurrently taught in the high schools. We do force concept surveys, pre and post test. We do electromagnetic or electricity and magnetism concept surveys, pre and post tests. And these are national standard concept surveys. So a database of performance exists. So we can compare not only our face-to-face course or our on-campus courses one against the another in terms of learning outcomes and what the education experts call normalized gain in terms of learning. And we find consistency when there are instances where the students are perhaps not performing up to the national average or the St. Cloud State average. We address those concerns with continual feedback loops and improvement mechanisms. And in particular, I'd like to indicate that the two of my recent senior to sophomore courses, the students outperformed the national average by a factor of 2. That's extraordinary, actually. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Haglund. Is there anyone in the audience from the public or otherwise who would like to testify to House File 704? Members, questions? Good morning, everyone. Members? Does anyone have a question? Well, Representative Howe, I don't know what to say. This is very unusual for this committee not to have some questions, but please continue. Oh, thank you. Representative Daphne, thank you.
You seem to want one. I'll skip the what should I have for lunch question, which is, you know. But I apologize, I was late this morning, so I missed the setup on the bill. But is your intent that the high school teacher who's licensed to teach would create the exam for the college professor who's not licensed to teach? Or what's your thought here?
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Dabney. No, my thought is that curriculum at the college, if that was the curriculum and the test and the syllabus that you would, or a course outline, whichever they decide to use, I'm not hung up on the term syllabus, but I would think that if you're going to go, like my daughter went to PSEO at St. Cloud State, I'm an alum from St. Cloud State, so I think it's a quality organization and an educational facility. But the concern I have is if there is not enough, you know, I believe that St. Cloud State possibly does a great job, but there's other outfits out there, other institutions that may not do quite what we're hearing here today, but this would give a ground level that if you went to, as my daughter did, the actual PSEO where she went to St. Cloud State and took the course as a high school senior, and sat in the same course, if she would have taken that as concurrent enrollment at Ricori High School, that would have been the same. At the end of the day, they would have gotten the same educational opportunity and got to the same level. And I know we're not saying it's got to be exact, but at least a reasonable expectation that you're going to take the same exam, a similar exam, at the same level as you would whether you're at concurrent enrollment or whether you go to post-secondary educational opportunity.
Madam Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you. So, Representative Howe, you don't think Ricori is a quality institution. You established that you thought St. Cloud University was a quality institution, but you don't think Ricori is a quality institution.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, I never said that. In fact, if Ricori didn't do an excellent job, my daughter wouldn't have been at the level to take the college course. So I never implied. In fact, I think Ricori did an excellent job preparing her to be able to take that course at St. Cloud State as a college senior or as a high school senior. What I'm saying is that I would like, and I'm not pouring, trying to throw arrows at St. Cloud State, but I believe all institutions out there of higher learning, you should have some quality control that says if I take concurrent enrollment or if I take PSEO or if I go to the college, whichever course I should be taking the similar exam and having the same similar outcome. And I think what this bill does is give some guidelines and some structure and some assurances that that's going to happen.
Madam Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Reverend Howe, I no disagreement on the goal here. That's why we require concurrent enrollment schools to be accredited. That's the usual method towards assuring quality. So you keep saying that they should have similar exams, but your bill says exact same. So is it you want similar exams and similar instruction, or you want the exact same? Because there's a difference between what your bill says and what you're saying. And I'm just trying to understand what you mean when your bill says exact same, but you're saying similar.
Representative Howe.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, my bill says the same, and I actually believe and I think the same would be appropriate if we can get there. I'm not hung up on the exact same, but I believe that should be the goal, that the exam, to me, should be prepared by the institution. But when you say that they're accredited, I would venture to say that I don't believe all concurrent enrollment programs are accredited in the state of Minnesota. Can you assure me that that's the case?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Dabney.
Under law, they need to be moving towards accreditation or be accredited. So they need to be in a rigorous process towards accreditation. Mm-hmm. So we do have methods in place already and have had for a number of years to assure quality. I'm just trying to understand, you've got high school teachers who are trained in teaching methods, trained in assessment methods, who write tests for a living, and then you've got college instructors, no offense, doctor, but your training far more rigorous than mine, but not in pedagogy, not in assessment, and yet we're going to have them be the ones who write the tests. And I'm just a little confused here about what's the quality shortage in K-12 teaching.
Representative Howe.
Madam Chair and Representative Dabney, I'm going to answer that, and then I'm going to let my testifier answer to respond. But we're talking about a college-level course, and Representative Dabney, if you're telling me that the high school teacher is qualified to teach a high school-level or the college course, he's that teacher can go to the college and become a professor without any additional training, I don't believe that that's the case. Not that I'm a college professor, but I don't believe that that's the case. I know that under concurrent enrollment, they have to be mentored by that college professor. But I think that when we did the concurrent enrollment in the PSEO program, I believe we blurred those lines somewhat. And I think we need to provide some structure to make that, make sure that we're meeting the end goal that we'd like. But I'll let the testifier respond.
Testifiers, Madam Chairman, testifiers have the advantage of being in both bodies. I've testified in front of the Senate on several occasions, Senate committees, and Representative Senator Clausen pointed out the last time, this was two times ago when a similar bill was heard, that his investigation yielded that only 11 or 12 of the Minsky institutions offering concurrent enrollment were in fact accredited by the accrediting body. So I didn't want your belief that people follow the law simply because it's the law was the case. That's one of the concerns that I have.
Well, Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Dabney.
Sir, the law doesn't require them to be accredited. The law requires them to be working towards accreditation. Do you have a list of higher ed institutions who are violating the law for us? Because if you do, that's very different than Representative Howe's bill. That's a very significant accusation you're making. And if you're making that accusation, I'd like to see your evidence for it. Because you're also misrepresenting the law. The law does not require them to be accredited, although my House file does require them to become accredited. But the current law requires them to be moving towards it, going through that rigorous process. So are you saying institutions are breaking the law? No. And if so, which institutions?
Mr. Palmer.
Madam, I'm not saying that. Your Senator Clausen is the one on record in the hearing of his bill that addresses the matters of concurrent enrollment, that, and my memory is such that I haven't got the transcript in front of me, that he had said that only 11 or 12 of the Minsky institutions were in fact in compliance. I'm citing Senator Clausen. I'm not citing my information. I had a handout that was provided to the members, and I'd call attention to it. The handout I did not prepare. The handout is prepared by the Center for Continuing Studies, which shows the annual report for last year. And one of the areas in which they report is that there was to be on file 101 syllabi. Only 69 were turned in. And I am concerned about my grandchildren and the other children who are engaging in programming where it's not as clean and pretty as some people would have us believe. I have information that is voluminous about things that should trouble you. I tried to keep my testimony to the bill today, which is a bill that would require a syllabi, and I passed this document out by the people that just testified to you that say that there's a shortcoming in our practice. And of course, I'm not without sin. Things are not perfect in the world. And that's why when I talked to Representative Howe about this, he agreed to introduce a bill. That he agreed to introduce a bill to get the matter in front of the body to consider what's going on with this thing called concurrent enrollment, what's happening in the state with regard to providing access to college experience for high school students.
Madam Chair?
Representative Dabney.
Representative Howe, given the handout, can you share with the committee your conversations with St. Cloud State University to understand faculty has submitted course syllabi in the 69 versus 101. You're a Navy vet. You understand following, going up the ladder, right?
The only discussions I had with St. Cloud State were with a few professors and with some of the government relations folks at St. Cloud State.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Yarusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The bill doesn't actually introduce a requirement to submit the syllabus. It just says they have to use the same one, and so it doesn't seem to me that that actually fixes the problem you were just talking about. And if the problem is that people aren't following the existing law, I don't see why there'd be any reason to suspect they would follow this. But that wasn't my original concern for why I put my hand up. Representative Howe, what is your plan under your bill for choosing among different sections of a course that are taught by different members of the faculty at the same institution?
Representative Howe?
Could you repeat that? I was a little preoccupied.
What is your plan under your bill for dealing with choosing among the different sections of a course taught by different members of the faculty at the same institution?
Representative Howe.
Madam Chair and Representative Urso, I don't think we're really concerned with you've got different professors teaching different sections of the course. As long as they are approved through the concurrent enrollment to be the mentor to that high school, you know, I think that they put their syllabus on file like I believe the requirement is, and they follow that procedure and they meet the requirements, and you've given that high school senior the same opportunities and the same scrutiny, the same test, the same evaluation, and you come up with the same type of grading system. I think that'd be the fair assumption that you're that it's a good idea.
Madam Chair,
Representative Russo.
Representative Howe, that's not how it works. That's not how it works in college.
Representative Howe.
I'm sorry. When you have different sections of a course taught by different members of the faculty, except in certain courses that are given common exams, each instructor, each professor has the freedom to develop their own syllabus, develop their own exams. The exam, in fact, if you're any good at all, is different every time you give it. And there's no expectation, zero expectation, that the syllabus or the final exam or even the materials that are read in a course are the same from one section to another, even sections that are taught by the same instructor. And so when you have this requirement that it be the same syllabus, the same final exam, the same grading scale as the equivalent course, that doesn't have any meaning in college.
Representative Urso, I believe what we're trying to do, when you have a college professor that is the mentor for that high school classroom, I believe that that should be the equivalent, because that's where that instruction to that and the guidance to that high school teacher is coming from.
Madam Chair. Representative Urso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's not what the bill says. The bill doesn't say that it's the same as the person who's mentoring them. And in fact, the person who's mentoring them may have different sections of the same course where they have different materials in different sections. There's no meaning to the same here unless you've got some kind of procedure to determine, to have somebody make that determination. And you have different access to materials also. A professor on campus has the ability to put materials on reserve in their library. You're not necessarily going to have the same materials. And that professor may have to make different accommodations if they teach an online version of it versus their in-class version. So this idea that it's going to be the same just doesn't work at the college level. That's not how college works. We've had this kind of fiction before here that somehow there's some uniformity to the college experience, when in reality the college experience is all about divergence. And academic freedom is a key principle among university faculty and college faculty. And the ability to develop one's own syllabus is part of the experience of being a college-level instructor. And that ongoing dialogue between you and your students. So I've had courses where I've changed the syllabus as we went through the course in response to the needs of the students that we had. And that was a master's level course. So I don't think this bill reflects the college experience. I don't think it's realistic. I don't think you've thought it through. And I don't think you actually realize what courses at the college level actually look like and how they work. So I don't think this is ready. I agree that it is a really good idea to have some standards, and we really ought to enforce the rules that we've got in place. But it takes a lot more dialogue than this, and this is just really overly simplistic.
Representative Howe.
Madam Chair and Representative Uso, I never said it was the end-all, be-all, and I didn't say that I wasn't willing to work on it. I'm all about if you want to help me structure this and change the verbiage to make it work at the next level, I'm more than willing to do that. But I do believe that we need to start the conversation someplace, and I do believe that there's a difference between a concurrent enrollment program taught at the high school and a college level, and even the PSEO experience when you actually go to the college and sit in the classroom as my daughter did. But I do believe that we have to take a step in the direction to bring some structure to the program, to me, where we do have some of these concurrent enrollment processes and programs that are completely off the tracks. And I'm not saying it's at St. Cloud State, and I'm not saying it's at the physics department, but I do believe that there are some out there that are doing it all for the good almighty dollar and to pad their and to create some counting. So I'm more than willing to work with you on it. I just think that we need to put some structure to the program, and I think this is a step in the direction, and if you want to work with me on it before it gets to the next stop, I'm more than willing to do so.
Representative Uruso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd be happy to, although under the timelines we're on right now, I don't know how we can fix this in 1 week or 2 weeks, because it needs some conversations at the college level. So what I'd be really happy to do is work with you and aim this at next year, because this is a pure policy item. This isn't a fiscal item at all, as far as I can see. It's pure policy. We can do it next year. And if that's the case and you want me to work with you, I have access, you know, I mean, I'm in the Moundsview district, and they've been working really, really closely with their local community college to develop their system. And so I'm pretty sure I can get access to some people that we can talk to and try to thrash it out. But I don't think we should shortchange it and try to hurry it up and shove it through in time to get in an omnibus bill.
Representative Howell? I believe at this time I'm going to change Representative Erickson's motion before we continue our discussion to lay this bill over, just because there are a lot of issues here. So is there any further discussion on the bill? Would the others like to chime in still? Representative Ward?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems like we woke up and
coffee kicked in.
Caffeine.
Yeah. Once we got started, it does seem a simple thing, simple language and pretty direct. And I think that we've had a presumption that the concurrent enrollment meant that students were getting the quality of education that we intended for them to get. And we want them to have that quality education so that they're not getting to college then later with substandard preparation. That's misrepresenting what we're trying to do and unfair to students and their families. So we want them to meet a standard, but the bill suggests to me that concurrent enrollment is not to be trusted. You've suggested, you've made some statements about not knowing whether or not others are or aren't. So I'm really wondering where this came from. Apparently from the Senate, but it just strikes me as challenged, and that maybe we're not we do need to spend more time on it, and maybe this isn't the best time because we have other things we need to talk about as well. And I would agree, maybe we should wait.
Representative Howell?
Well, and I think that's part of the problem is of not being able to get a hearing until you're already in the midst of the final things, and so that's probably the case. But I would venture to say that some of the stories I've heard about some of these secondary educational institutions out there and some of the processes that have gone on really raises a red flag for me. And, I'm not here to raise a big and air any institution's dirty laundry out there. I would prefer to just try to be where we're trying to fix something without and give some structure that to me, I think all institutions would be successful at. And I think to put some real structure to it and to give some guidance and some assurances to both, because what we're talking about here is not the institutions. We're talking about the children. And, you can slam me for maybe not having the right verbiage in. I don't have a problem with that. But I think what we should be doing is making good policy, and I think there's some opportunities here to make some good policies to make sure that those students and those children are getting well prepared and getting what they're actually believe that they're going through to get. And I don't believe that there's enough structure out there right now to make that happen. And I believe if Representative Dabney believed that it was all good in the world, we wouldn't be having his bill that I heard the other day also. So I think that we all agree that there's some opportunities for success here. Maybe I didn't use the correct verbiage when this thing was drafted. I'll take that hit. But it's kind of, I wish somebody would have came and offered that to me, that guidance to me when they first seen the bill instead of waiting until the committee to come after it. But that's fine with me. Madam Chair, I'm good with this. If we're going to lay the bill over, I'm good with that, and hopefully we can make some headway onto it, because I don't want to spend a whole ton of money on it. I don't think we need to. I think we can do it with some good policy to put some good structure in it and be successful in the future.
Thank you. All right. Representative Ergal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifiers from Princeton on the Prairie. Well, I'm a graduate. I just want to make sure I understand. A supervising mentor teacher at St. Cloud State dealing with a concurrent enrollment instructor in a high school, you don't provide a syllabus, final exam, or grading scale, or do you?
We do. We it is usually a collaborative effort, and the university faculty always provides the high school faculty with a syllabus from our campus, and they get a syllabus from the high school campus. They work together to make sure that the learning objectives are the same for our course, that they are completely included in the course that's being offered at the high school site. Often a concurrent enrollment course might run all year, so there's often opportunity to have additional content in a high school section than we have on our campus, where our courses are one semester long. So they aren't exactly the same because of the reasons people talked before about, the difference between a syllabus in one section and another section. But the key elements are the same. They are approved each year. Whether or not everybody hands them in like we asked them to, they exist and they are approved by the faculty mentor. Exams are quite different on campus, and Dr. Hagelin could maybe speak to that better than I.
Madam Chair, committee, yes, indeed. From one section of physics to a next section of physics, the exams are not the same, and this it turns out to be a very good thing because they don't happen at the same times under the same circumstances. And with social media, if we had a common exam 30 minutes after or if we tried to have a common exam 30 minutes after Section 1 completed the exam, Section 2 students would know about the questions. So this is impractical in some sense. Let me come back to the issue of syllabi. At least in our unit, 100% of the syllabi are approved in the department faculty meetings. The high school syllabi have been approved. We interact with these high school teachers on multiple occasions. We go out to the schools and visit and present and interact with the students. We invite the students to come to campus for a physics laboratory experience, and we're in with the students, and so we have a fairly good sense as to the level of communication, the level of learning that's going on. And so it isn't willy-nilly. It's actually fairly consistent across the sections that we have and also the concurrent enrollment sections that we have. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Erdahl?
Well, thank you. That gives me some comfort, although I get this feeling that Representative Howell is eager to respond here.
Representative Howell?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Erdahl. I would venture to say that if that was the case in all concurrent enrollment processes, we wouldn't be sitting here having this discussion. Representative Dabney wouldn't have his bill there. I don't believe that that's similar in all cases. I think that they brought the shining star here as the performer. I don't believe that's the case in all courses at St. Cloud State, nor in all campuses across Minnesota. So, you know, if you're going to bring a testifier, you bring the shining star and let him shine. I don't know if that's the case in all programs that it all works so eloquently. I would challenge.
Representative Erdahl?
No, I'm done.
All right, thank you. Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, I think a lot of the points were already addressed, and so I'm glad that we've had this conversation. But I think the goal is we want to make sure, as Representative Ward said, that the programs that we have in place for the different choices that we have for our students have some consistency, so that if you take a psychology course at St. Cloud State, or you take it in our schools, or you take an AP psychology course, that is an equivalent. But I'm going to agree that the word that bothers me is same. So similar or comparable or something along that line, I think might be a better word maybe to get it where we're trying to go. So that's my suggestion.
Representative Howell.
Well, Madam Chair, and I would agree that that's a pretty simple change, but I don't think you're going to find agreeing that changing that on the other side of the fence here is going to fix that problem.
Representative Peterson? Okay. Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Howell, for bringing forward this bill. And I won't belabor. I agree. I think many people here are disturbed a little bit by the word "the same," and there's practical implications, as was pointed out by the professor here. But I just want to say, and I think it's great that you've agreed to work on this and to have it reflect the realities of the college situation today. But I just want us to remember, as we focus on the students, which you talked about, I think it's more helpful for us to focus on the actual outcomes those students in the concurrent enrollment courses are experiencing and how we can build upon that to make that better and make sure it is at the college level, rather than saying I don't believe that this is happening, or when you look at the funding stream, I don't think you're talking about padding pockets. I don't think that anyone is getting rich off of the concurrent enrollment situation. I know schools are cross-subsidizing the concurrent enrollment situation. So my hope is just that we focus on the children, on the students, on what outcomes they're having now, and how we can ensure, if in some cases those outcomes are not at the college level, that they are at the college level.
Representative Howe? All right. Well, at this time, then, I'll renew the motion that will lay this bill over and look forward to further work with the bill. Thank you so much for your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for the conversation. Hopefully, we can make some headway on this concurrent enrollment piece, because I am got grave concerns that this isn't the program that we all signed up for. Thank you.
Okay, we'll lay the bill on the table then. And next we'll hear House File 809, Representative Gunther. All right. Well, at this point, we'll do I have a motion to move the bill, House File 809?
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members.
I think
House File 809 is something that the Senate Bipartisan Rural Caucus worked on, and in our committee, we made it statewide. And we need to make sure every high school student can get the best job they can when they graduate. But we can't help unless they know what jobs are available. With this legislation, we can better connect students with available job positions in their communities. And with that, Madam Chairman, I would like to have Ann Kiltzer, East V. Olson, testify and tell you about the bill.
Okay. Representative Gunther, before we do that, I'm going to make the motion to send this House File 809 to the Job Growth and Energy Affordability Committee. Make sure we get that on the recording. And what was your last name?
Kiltzer.
Ms. Kiltzer, go ahead then.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Ann Kiltzer, formerly Olson, as Representative Gunther stated, Director of the Minnesota Workforce Council Association. Our association represents the providers of the adult, dislocated worker, and youth employment and training services delivered in the workforce centers across the state. There are 16 workforce service areas covering all of 87 counties in Minnesota. In each area, Workforce Investment Board, which is employer-led, provides strategic guidance. House File 809 includes initiatives that will greatly enhance the ability of workforce areas to address the needs of youth and local employers. First, funding is included for workforce systems coordinators. We hear more and more about a skills gap and a workforce shortage. The statewide workforce system has been successful in bringing together local entities, including education, government, nonprofits, and employers, to identify and coordinate on employment and training initiatives. This bill would provide funding for efforts that would cross program silos and help connect the dots between various efforts for better alignment. Second, House File 809 includes funding for the Minnesota Youth Program. The unemployment for youth has stayed stubbornly high despite economic growth of the last several years. Unemployment rates among youth are especially a concern during the summer as more want to enter the workforce. MYP provides work readiness training, which focuses on skills, as well as behaviors employers value such as attendance, punctuality, teamwork, communication skills, and problem solving. MYP also provides work experience opportunities. Without MYP, many young people will be delayed in their ability to get a job in which they can develop their basic skills. Most relevant to this committee, House File 809 includes provisions to expand one of our core activities, career exploration and planning. Connecting youth to careers and corresponding additional education needs to be a priority of the workforce development system, as it is essential to the future economy of the state and to our young people. And you understand this. In 2013, the legislature passed the World's Best Workforce legislation, which, among other things, requires school districts to assist all students no later than ninth grade to explore college and career interest aspirations and develop a transition plan to post-secondary education or employment. As we are well aware, however, the demands of Minnesota's high school counselors are intense, with our average student-to-counselor ratios higher than most states. but there is help to be found by leveraging resources. Also in 2013, the legislature provided funding for four of Minnesota's 16 workforce service areas to partner with local school districts to complement the work of school counselors by providing school staff, students, and families with the most current career and post-secondary education information available. I've provided a report on these four pilot projects, and the results have been impressive. So far, the four sites have served 1,516 youth through individualized services and 6,495 through group activities by leveraging existing career advisors' knowledge and resources. To be clear, this is not meant to replace or supplant the work of current school counselors. Our youth workforce advisors can partner and support their work. I provided a handout which gives examples of partnerships offered in Northeast Minnesota, which is a model we'd like to take statewide. As you'll see from a quote on the bottom of page 3 of the outcomes report, it is our experience that school counselors are very happy to have this assistance from partners in the public workforce system. The legislation Representative Gunther is putting before you today would allow these partnerships to be implemented in all 16 workforce service areas and provided in all 87 counties across the state. All of our members are very excited about these potential partnerships and more than willing and ready to provide the services. We strongly appreciate your support of this initiative, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay. Representative Urusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two different questions. First, you've said this is to apply throughout the state and at all of the workforce service centers, but the language in the bill in a couple of different places has this except language. Except for a service center that serves a single city, comma, located outside of the metropolitan area, comma. So first, are there those two different exceptions, except for a single city and except for, you know, only outside the metropolitan area?
Madam Chair and members, Representative Gunther, this issue came up at the first stop that this bill had, and Representative Gunther had indicated to Representative Moran, actually, who had asked the question in the policy committee, that the funding for the career counselors he's willing to provide statewide, and I believe that he's planning to do an author's amendment at the next meeting.
That's correct.
Representative Gunther.
Madam Chairman, and we had an amendment drafted while we were in committee to include the whole state. I can't think of areas of the state that don't need this. We have many students that are not going to go to post-secondary education. And because of that, we want to make sure they have an opportunity to get training for a job that they, best job that they possibly can get. And we are willing to do the aptitude, ability, and interest testing of these students. Job shadowing to show them what category of jobs they would fit into, and then maybe even suggest that they take certain courses at the sophomore level, junior and senior level, so they would be better at those categories of jobs. So that's the purpose of this bill, is to prepare them for the workforce as well as fill the much needed trained employees that employers need.
Representative Urusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm not understanding why that amendment didn't make it on. I mean, why you don't have it for us?
Representative Gunther.
I don't either, but it will be there. It's in the Senate, and it's something that I very much want to have there.
Representative Urusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then my other question, because at the last line of page 2, continuing on to page 3, it allows part of the money to include career guidance in schools. Would this be through the use of licensed school counselors, because they'd be working in the schools?
Representative Gunther?
Madam Chairman, Representative Urusso, it would be because of the stress on existing school counselors, it would be done by workforce center personnel who have been doing ability, aptitude, and interest testing for years and years, and they're working with the career counselors as much as possible. Dr. Walter Roberts from Mankato, University of Minnesota Mankato, came to my office, and he was thrilled about this program. And I assured him that in no way do we want to replace or do anything with career counselors, but probably get more of them.
Representative Urizo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, as I understand it, the shortage of counselors in the schools is not due to a shortage of available licensed people. It's strictly due to a shortage of money that has been allocated for that purpose. And since your bill allocates the money, I'm concerned that that we would not be using licensed counselors who have the training to work with kids in the school. So that's something I think we might need to look at. I mean, it might, in fact, already, you know, since we already have policy requiring licensing for counselors, that you need to take that into consideration or do something to change that. So that'd be something we ought to look at.
Representative Gunther?
It's my understanding that when school districts are in a financial crunch, one of the first people that they go is the career counselors. And that is a quote directly from Dr. Walter Roberts, who's been in the field for 30 years.
Madam Chair?
Representative Urizo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's my point. Okay, the shortage is not of the trained, licensed people. The shortage is strictly the budget. And since this would provide the budget, I would like to know whether that budget would go toward the licensed trained people or someone else. So, you know, simply because it's happening in the schools and we do have the requirements for counseling in the schools.
Representative Gunther.
If we gave the money that we're going to hire these counselors to the schools, I feel that the same thing would happen that's happening now. This minute the school district got into a financial crunch, those counselors would go. These are no longer going to be their personnel, and it's going to be personnel that's going to be helping them. They're very well qualified to do this. They do this for people that are outside of school all the time. That's their job. And we're going to enhance the ability of existing career counselors to handle those students that aren't going to Harvard.
Representative Urizo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Gunther, I want to make sure you understand that I'm very sympathetic to this bill. I just want to make it work. And what you don't know is that we had a previous conversation in this committee about agricultural teachers, in which an awful lot of it hinged on this this contractual relationship, you know, having someone coming in from the outside working in the school with the kids. And it opens up some areas of difficulty because we guard the border of the school pretty religiously in terms of who works with the kids and what kind of training they have and what they're accountable for and their reporting requirements, you know, and you know, the mandated reporters and so on and so on. And those are not things you learn in a quick workshop with somebody. So when you've got somebody in the school building, it's a different relationship than when someone goes outside and seeks services from someone in the outside world, because the parents give their kids over to the school for the day, and they have an extra responsibility. So rather than just dismiss the idea, I really wish that what we could agree to here is that we would look at that and work on that and make sure we get it right. Otherwise, if you just let it stand the way it is, if somebody's in the school working with the kids, they're probably subject to the school policies that we have. So, thanks.
Representative Gunther? Oh, all right. Representative Moran?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Gunther, you're right. We did discuss this in Greater Minnesota, economic workforce development, about making this a statewide initiative. But the bill is still in the current form. And, you know, I'm a believer that, you know, just because we say it, you know, in our presentation doesn't make it so, because what we have in this bill is what will become law. And so, you know, what is your expectation as this bill go on? Because I would just be a little leery in trying to support this if it continues to stay in this current form as it travels.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you. It will change. The Senate bill has already changed. Senator Bonner made sure that it was. She came and visited me. She felt very comfortable in doing this. She says we can amend it at a later time, and it will be in the jobs omnibus bill. It's not taking a dime away from education funding, and it's something that will happen. You have my assurance of that.
Okay. Thank you. Madam Chair.
Representative Moran.
And one last question, you know, in the on page 3, on your last paragraph, 3.5, it talks about activities in the workforce services under this paragraph may serve all youth up to age 24. And it's not that often that we see a 24-year-old as a youth. And so I'm just wondering, where did this age come from?
Representative Gunther?
Madam Chair and members, the funding that's provided is the funding mechanism would be the Minnesota Youth Program, which currently serves youth. The up to age 24 would put it in alignment with the federal funding that also serves youth. So that's a piece that we're hoping is aligned. This would make the outreach to schools an allowable activity under the current Minnesota Youth Program. So the Minnesota Youth Program would not only be doing the outreach to schools piece, but also the employment opportunities piece that the current Minnesota Youth Program provides. So the outreach to schools piece obviously would be targeted towards youth who are in school, but this program also serves out-of-school youth.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Moran? Thank you. Representative Winkler?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Gunther, I want to just kind of drill in a little bit more. So are all the is it your intention that all of the appropriations in the bill will be available statewide?
Representative Gunther.
Confident it is. Senator Monoff made sure of that in their bill, and I haven't had time to amend this bill, or it would be done.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Gunther, just to ask one final question. So before this bill leaves the Minnesota House of Representatives as a whole, it will be amended to include all kids in the state?
Representative Gunther.
Thank you.
We want to make sure that happens.
All right, Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, because this is uncomplicated, I would move that we make that change right now because it's a simple deletion. And I just want to clarify with Representative Gunther whether he this change is only for Section 3 or if it's for throughout the bill, to strike the language that accepting some of the work centers.
Representative Gunther?
What page and line?
Well, on page 1, lines 1.9 and 1.10, there is language 1.8 through 1.10. After service center, comma, except for a service center that serves a single city located outside of the metropolitan area as defined in section 473.121 subdivision 2, comma. That's the first instance. And then the second instance, that is the part that applies to the schools, is on page 2, lines 2.32 to 2.33. Again, after service center, comma, the identical language occurs through the end of line 2.33. And to accomplish this, we would not have to create any new language, I believe, although obviously I would ask Ms. Larson for clarification, but merely strike that phrase. So the first question is, are you amenable to that, and is the chair amenable to that? And then the second question is, did you mean that, is this throughout the entire state only for the part about schools, or is it for the whole bill?
Representative Gunther.
I would be very amenable to that, striking that language and making it statewide.
Madam Chair, for the entire bill?
For the whole entire bill.
Thank you. If Ms. Larson could, if it's okay with the chair.
Yeah. Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, Representative Yaruso, as I understand your request, what you're proposing is to amend House File 809 on page 1, line 8, delete everything after the comma, page 1, delete line 9, and page 1, line 10, delete everything through the second comma. Madam Chair, Representative Urusso, on page 1, line 8, we don't need the first comma either. So it would be delete everything from the comma onward on 1.8, page 1, delete line 9, page 1, line 10, delete everything through the second comma. And on page 2, line 32, delete everything after the comma. Page 2, line 33, delete the entire line.
Representative Gunther.
Including Madam Chairman, if everybody understands that amendment, I'd be very amenable to have that.
Are we also put including deleting the rule?
Representative Urusso, are you making a motion then to amend House File 809 or no? Representative Urusso?
Where did you say?
Yeah.
Line 2.22. There's a comment about gnawing rural workforce system. So the question is whether the rural is appropriate there.
Representative Ryan?
Yes, Madam Chair. So because I'm looking at the language of the bill, which is a really targeted focus on rural workforce system coordinated appropriation, you know, whether or not we need to change that language also.
Ms. Larson, any comments?
Madam Chair, perhaps you would like to ask the witness who is familiar with these Minnesota youth programs.
Okay. Ms. Kilter, any comments on that?
Madam Chair and members, to accomplish what you're trying to accomplish in regard to line 2.22, if you just took out the word rural, it should work for the intention that you're trying to get.
2.18. Okay. Representative Gunther.
And line 2.18, yes.
All right. Okay, Representative Gunther, that's okay.
That's fine.
All righty.
Thank you. So I'd like to move that amendment.
All right.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair and members.
Ms. Kilter.
Also in line 1.7, it uses the word rural.
Okay. Representative Urusso.
Thank you. So I'd like to move that oral amendment. I'm not sure if we need it to be restated, so we have it all in one piece.
Ms. Larson, shall we restate it all in one piece?
Yes, thank you.
Sure. Madam Chair, members, regarding the oral amendment to House File 809, page 1, line 7, delete rural, page 1, line 8, delete everything from the comma onward, page 1, delete line 9, page 1, line 10, delete everything through the second comma. Page 2, line 18, delete the word rural. Page 2, line 22, delete the word rural. Page 2, line 32, delete everything after the comma. Page 2, delete line 33.
Representative Urusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 2, we needed to delete that comma also. Oh, excuse me. No. And we've discovered two more spots, line 1.12 and line 1.13, the word rural.
Ms. Larson, got that. Can you state that again, Representative Urusso?
Line 1.2 and line 1.3. Delete the word rural. Oh, and line 1.2, it recurs twice.
Madam Chair.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I would think that we might be better off doing this in a written amendment in another time, in another place. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure we all trust Representative Gunther to help us get it right. So maybe we can move this along, and if it's, you know, policy-wise a bill we can all support in concept, I'm sure we can get it right as we move through the process.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would encourage that. We've got lots of moving parts here. I also want to just emphasize the it is going to be statewide, so we really do want the rural aspect, rural and metro. I don't know whether you actually want to say that or not, but statewide too, just to
statewide is good.
So that it's clear that we really want
rural, urban, suburban, metro, wide. But the rural area is also clearly important. I also wanted to comment on the kindergarten through grade 12 focus, so that we're building towards something and not just all of a sudden looking at the end and saying, all right, now kids, figure out how to do this. We'll help you figure it out, but there needs to be something that's more practical early on, and I want to applaud you for doing that. The other aspect is going to age 24, because I think that addresses a lot of kids who we've not served well, who have dropped out, or who have are struggling getting settled in the new economy. So I appreciate both of those pieces, but I really want to reinforce that we need to pay attention to the rule. We want kids to be able to stay in their communities and be productive there.
Representative Gunther.
Yeah, I do too. I think probably the most depressed individual there is a college dropout, and we want to be able to offer this to them also. I think they are truly, for lack of a better word, orphans. They don't have a lot going for them as far as workforce preparation or anything. So it's something that is one of my desires, and I think the senators who brought this to me probably feel the same way. Thank you. Thank you for all your help.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And Representative Yerusa, did you have another comment? We'll let her confer for a second here. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, considering the fact that the amendment got a bit more complicated on us than we anticipated, I'd like to take Representative Winkler's advice and withdraw my motion to do the oral amendment at this time, and we'll look to see it at the next stop.
Okay, so Representative Yerusa's motion for the oral amendment is withdrawn, and Representative Gunther, I'll let you make some final comments, but I believe the intention of this I'll make a motion to send this on to K-12 Finance with the intention that Representative Gunther will have a written amendment there to incorporate all these things. Do you have any final comments, Representative Gunther?
Well, I appreciate all the help that you've given this bill. I think you have articulated my desire for this bill very well.
Thank you. So I'll renew the motion to send this House File 809 to the K-12 Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. Thank you.
Representative Murphy, welcome to our committee. Members, we have two bills to finish before 9:59, so keep your questions relevant. And, excuse me. Representative Kreisha moves this bill. Go ahead.
Representative, I'll move that House File 1709 be re-referred to the Education Finance Committee.
Thank you, Representative Kreisha. Welcome to our committee, Representative Murphy. It's nice
to
have you, and thank you for bringing your testifiers. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, very much, members of the committee, for allowing us to come today and present to you a new idea, but not really. I'm Representative Mary Murphy from District 3B, but District 709 is part of my constituency, and 709 has a school, Ruth Myers-Marge Wilkins School, that is just outstanding. It's a community school, a real community school, and provides many services to the students. I believe that the school is the heart of the community, and I think most people in this state believe that the schools are the heart of the communities. They change. We used to have one-room schoolhouses, but that were the heart of the community. Once upon a time, the schools just operated from 8 o'clock to 3:30. That's changed. It was a neighborhood school. Sometimes that's changed. One day, the Murphy family sent the youngest person to school. That was Mary Catherine. The four boys walked with her to the school on the first day of school. That was her first experience. She had gone for a shot to the school early in the summer for vaccination. The public health nurse was there, and she knew the public health nurse because the public health nurse used to come when somebody had the measles or the mumps or impetigo. Public health nurse was in blue. Miss Salto was her name. Wonderful, wonderful person. But Mary Catherine had no experience with school. By the time we got to the top of the hill, the brother that was a senior and the brother that was a junior had been picked up by somebody in their car and went away. The two other brothers, fourth grader and the fifth grader, kept saying, "Hurry up, we got to get there, we got to play ball before school starts." So by the time Paul and Mary got to the school, half a mile later, Jimmy had already gone to play ball, and Paul was stuck. And he walked Mary into the school, and he looked at the first grader teacher there, in the first grade teacher's room here on the left, and he looked at them. And he said, "You go in there, she's the prettiest. She looks nice." So I went there and I sat. And pretty soon someone came along and said, "Mary Murphy, you belong over there." And that was the first experience with the school. But it didn't change a whole lot over the years. Parents weren't at the school and weren't involved. Grandparents surely weren't. But it was a wonderful experience, enlightening in every way. Even though you could only get two library books a week, and even though you had to carry your lunch, if you had it, and even though you didn't have music or art, but you still learned to read. And the community schools were just happening, starting to happen, when Mary Catherine started her teaching career. And by the end of her teaching career, the community schools were ensconced. And today we're here to tell you about the community schools in Hermantown and the community schools in, or not in Hermantown, in Duluth, and the community schools in Brooklyn Center, and what could be community schools all across the state. And I would like to introduce today Kathy Bogan, who is the coordinator of the community school for the Marge Wilkin Ruth Meyer School in Duluth, and Stephanie Hellig, who's the principal at that wonderful school, and Lucretia Grant, who is an alumni of that school. And then, when they are through, there are two others from Brooklyn Center that would like to speak, and they might not take as long as I do.
Thank you, Representative Murphy, and we'll move to your testifiers. We're on a time limited amount, so please, when you testify, would you tell us what will make this full-service community school a good policy for the state of Minnesota to adopt? So please say your name for the record and begin.
Sure. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for this opportunity to speak with you about the community schools model. I am Kathy Bogan, and I'm a founding member of the Myers-Wilkins Community School Collaborative in Duluth, Minnesota. Here with me are Stephanie Heilig, our Myers-Wilkins principal, and Lucretia Grant, alumni of our programs. We're here to describe for you how this nationally established model is improving academic achievement, health, and youth development at our neighborhood school and schools throughout the nation. Academic achievement does not take place in a vacuum. It is the result of multiple factors in a young person's life. Among these are the quality of their educational experiences, their physical and mental health, safety and stability of their home and community environment, participation in enrichment activities, and relationships with caring adults. The community school model addresses both academic rigor and the multifarious factors that influence young people's learning by locating needed services and supports at the school site. This is done in an intentional and well-aligned manner, resulting in a high level of family engagement and coordination of educational and supportive services. Briefly, at Myers-Wilkins Community School, adult family members, school staff, partner organizations, and community members came together over 16 years ago to develop and implement community school strategies so that every one of our young people would have the experiences and support needed to succeed in school, community, and life. Based on research and the promising practices of the Coalition for Community Schools, Myers-Wilkins now offers an extensive array of after-school and summer enrichment, academic intervention programs, family cultural and learning events, on-site dental care, and mental health services. The Minnesota Department of Health recently awarded Myers-Wilkins, in partnership with Generations Health and our community health care providers, a grant to pilot a family health initiative at our site. The results of our work together are making a positive difference in young people's lives, especially those experiencing the greatest barriers to academic achievement. Here are some examples. Although Myers-Wilkins is the highest poverty and most racially diverse school in Duluth, it has never been cited by the state of Minnesota for low achievement or failure to meet achievement gap reduction goals. Additionally, those students who attend the six-week summer school programs at Myers-Wilkins do not experience summer slide. Summer slide is a three-month or more regression in learning over the summer months that is common in children living in poverty. Lucretia Grant participated in the summer theater enrichment program as an elementary and middle school youth, and she would like to share her perspective on how these types of programs can influence the lifelong success of our young people.
Thank you, Ms. Bogan. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Lucretia Grant, and I'm so appreciative of the opportunity to speak in front of you today. Yes, as Kathy mentioned, I had the opportunity, along with my older brother and my younger sister, to participate in the East Hillside Theater Camp when I was in elementary and middle school. My sister and I worked in the costume shop and helped with set design for a couple of summers, and during that time we also did different initiatives learning about, our plays were always centered around learning about our environment. So we were right on Lake Superior. I remember we learned Raphael and Juliet, and it was centered around like fish. And my brother was, a facilitator. So he helped with the younger students. He was a little bit older than us. He was in high school at the time. And so I just remember that was a really enriching experience for all of us to be together for an entire summer, every single day to go to a place together. And how this has really impacted us as a family who we did grow up, you know, poor with a single mother. Who's so wise to get us into these programs. My brother went on to study musical theater at Boston Conservatory, and he is now in the national tour of the Broadway national tour of Jersey Boys, which will be here in May. and so he's been doing that for 2 years, and he is right now working on a business to help other students, you know, just get engaged with theater. He often says that theater, you know, changed his life, because before that he wasn't on the track of going to college. You know, he maybe wasn't into the greatest things, but he definitely changed things around. My sister is working on a master's degree in English at Howard University in D.C., and I graduated from Augsburg College in 2011, and I've been working as a clinic assistant at the Family Tree Clinic in St. Paul, and also working in education as well. And I just also want to mention that, you know, my mother was a single mother and didn't have a college education, but was very adamant that we would get a good education and do something, you know, a little bit more than maybe what she did. And she was so inspired by us all three of us going on to get 4-year degrees that she has just she's completing her first year in her AA degree at Lake Superior College. So we're just so proud of her, and I think that if the three of them were here with me now just sort of testify in front of you, they would say that yes, these programs definitely helped us, definitely gave us, just inspired us and gave us a view of what could be, you know, helped us to really generate creativity and push us forward. So yeah, that's my testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Grant, and you have a wise mother. Our last testifier, Representative Murphy, we can only have this testifier because we have to move your bill to the Finance Division, and we have Representative Moran's bill yet to hear. So please say your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Stephanie Heilig, and I have the privilege of being the principal at Myers-Wilkins Community School in Duluth. Just a few statistics about our school. 83% of our children live in poverty. 53% of them are children of color. This year, our school population, we've had a 20% turnover with children moving in and out. It's extremely transient. We have anywhere between 10 and 15% of our children who are homeless. 19% of our children are receiving special ed services, and we have been classified as a racially isolated school by the Minnesota Department of Education. But please, do not let those statistics define us. You may not know this, but I really do have the most amazing children in the world coming to my school, and my parents are so supportive. At Myers-Wilkins, we have a philosophy that every single child that walks through the door belongs to all of us, and it is our responsibility to work together to ensure that child is successful. We believe that building a strong community that begins in the classroom, radiates throughout the school, into after school, into the community, including the families, will enhance the social emotional learning and the academic achievement for all of our students. Our motto that we have emblazoned on all of our shirts is be kind, work hard. Even though many of our students have a hard life, we work together during school, after school, and in the evening to create an atmosphere of no excuses for success. In order for this to happen, though, for our students and our families, we need an absolutely seamless partnership between what happens in the school and what happens after school. All the barriers to our families need to be eliminated, and those barriers are things such as transportation, hunger, health issues, fear of safety, and financial challenges. Some of my biggest heroes are the families of our Myers-Wilkins children. I have many families that work multiple jobs, single parents. They get up early, make sure their children are dressed, their hair fixed, and send them off to school. That parent will go work 2 jobs. They may not get home until 7, 8, 9 o'clock at night. These parents cannot do it alone. Our school cannot do it alone. We are very concerned with closing the achievement gap. And we have done a good job, but we still want to do a better job. The efforts at reducing the achievement gap as measured by the MCA 13-14 last year, the achievement gap reduction domain measures the ability of schools to get higher levels of growth from lower performing student groups than the statewide average of higher performing Caucasian groups. In math at Myers-Wilkins, the following groups are making more growth than white students statewide in closing the achievement gap. And those groups are our Asian kids, our special ed kids, Hispanic and American Indian kids. The proficiency index rate of each group is compared to an established target. The groups from Myers-Wilkins that have met or exceeded the state target in math and reading are our American Indian students, black students, special ed students, and reduced lunch students. As a community school, we work collaboratively to ensure that all of our students have the opportunity to realize their dreams. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Representative Murphy, I hate to cut this short, but we do want to hear from Representative Moran. So with that, and thank you very much for your excellent testimony. This bill is going to finance, where I think Representative Murphy will be able to present her story again, and we can add the amendments. So with that, Representative Crescia, I'll renew your motion that House File 1709 be referred to the Committee on Education Finance. Thank you, and
thank you.
All those in favor? Oh, dear.
Aye.
Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed, no. The motion prevails and the bill is on its way. Representative Moran, we for sure want to hear from your testifiers. You know, just in case we have to continue your bill to Thursday, we want to hear testifiers. Members, on Thursday we have about five more bills that have passed through Senate first deadline that we want to hear. So, Representative Moran, if you would please move House File 1428. And this will be moving also to K-12.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 1428.
Representative Moran moves House File 1428 to be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. Please explain your bill. And I think you have an amendment, don't you?
I do. I have two amendments.
So Representative Moran moves 1428A2, is that correct?
That is correct.
That would be the policy amendment, Representative Moran. Please explain your amendment.
So, let's see. The A2 amendment. So, the second amendment is an appropriation. No, this is the policy. It's an intent of this bill to change the eligibility guideline for Part C only, not the Part B or special education. This amendment makes that clarification.
Is there any discussion, members? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Welcome to our committee and members, this is a very interesting, look at homelessness, as we've been discussing in this committee. And so with that, we'd like to hear from the testifiers. Rules will not be coming in, so members, please indulge. We may go past 10 o'clock a little bit. Please say your name for the record and begin, whoever would like to testify first.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Peggy Flanagan, and I'm the Executive Director of Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. Thank you for allowing me to testify this morning, and thank you, Representative Moran, for bringing this bill forward. Part C Early Intervention, which falls under the IDEA, is an effective program for infants and toddlers who have a developmental delay or who have a physical or mental condition that is likely to result in a developmental delay, such as low birth weight, Down syndrome, fetal alcohol syndrome, etc. Part C services, which could include physical therapy or occupational therapy for a gross or fine motor development delay, speech therapy for a speech delay, or many other services for types of delays that are coordinated and delivered through the child's school district. Early intervention services are delivered in the child's natural environment, usually the child's home, with the child's parents or caregivers as active participants in the therapy sessions. MDE, the lead agency for Part C, works with both DHS and MDH to find eligible young children to deliver these services. One of the difficulties for Part C can be finding infants and toddlers and their families who traditionally have very few connections with the school district. As such, there are about a dozen interagency early intervention committees throughout the state who work to connect families who may have an eligible child.
We believe strongly in this program and want to ensure that children and their families can connect with these critical services. According to a 2009 MnLINC study, one-third of children who received PART services did not need special education by second or third grade. CDF and the Visible Child Initiative of the Family Housing Fund believe that Part C program can be especially beneficial for young children who are homeless. Our homeless infants and toddlers experience developmental delay at more than four times the rate of other children. 54% of homeless infants and toddlers have a developmental delay, and the majority have a delay in more than one domain. As a result of legislation that CDF and the Visible Child Initiative brought forward in 2013, MDE now tracks annually and reports to the legislature the number of homeless infants and toddlers referred to Part C. According to their first report, which was published in July, 8 infants and toddlers were referred to the program. However, according to Wilder Research 2012 study, 840 infants and toddlers are homeless on any given night in Minnesota. Our young homeless children are invisible to this important program, and we need to make certain that they are served. One way to make homeless children visible is to help ensure that they receive critical early intervention services to make them categorically eligible for Part C through an at-risk definition, a developmental delay due to environmental or behavioral risk. A handful of other states have expanded their Part C eligibility to include children who are homeless, though it is important to note that most states require more than one risk factor to be eligible. That being said, the trauma of homelessness almost always means that children have experienced a multitude of risk factors in their young lives, including poverty, witnessing domestic abuse, having a parent with an undiagnosed or untreated mental illness, and living without safe or stable housing. The 2012 report from the Humphrey Institute, Mothering While Homeless, a qualitative analysis of access to child services by young mothers in Hennepin County, captures the experiences of homeless mothers aged 18 to 24 of children aged 0 to 3. The primary takeaway from this report is that these mothers have a deep desire to take an active role in the healthy development of their child. Those of us who are parents absolutely want the best for our children, and we should expect no less from parents of young children experiencing homelessness. Part C empowers parents to take an active role in the development of their children. Part C is an important component of the early childhood continuum of services and a critical piece of the school readiness puzzle. And we believe this is especially the case for infants and toddlers who are homeless. We look forward to working with you to ensure that infants and toddlers are on track to meet developmental milestones so that they can have healthy childhoods and productive adulthoods. Thank you.
Thank you very much. There certainly is a need, isn't there? Oh, my goodness. Looking at this handout from the Children's Defense Fund. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Hello, I'm Ann Maston. I'm a Regents Professor at the University of Minnesota in Child Development, and I also co-chair the Forum on Investing in Young Children Globally for the U.S. National Academies of Science. And I want to speak briefly based on the research I've done my entire career on risk and resilience, and since 1989, on homeless and highly mobile children, particularly in the metro area, but also statewide. Our early research showed a very high risk for educational, health, and behavior problems in homeless children. They share many of the same risk factors as other impoverished children, but they're higher on cumulative risk indicators, as was already indicated. In our recent research, we have been able to collaborate with shelter providers and the Minneapolis Public Schools and other districts in this area to show that these children, by the time they begin standardized testing, and we can follow them longitudinally with test data, they are way behind, and they show are significantly lower in achievement in math and reading compared to children who are at very high risk due to poverty alone. They show significantly more risk than the children, for example, who are qualified for free lunch. So there's something about that high cumulative risk. We also know that early reading, our data shows that early reading achievement in first grade is an excellent predictor of how well they will do on standardized testing in the future. We see that these gaps emerge early and they do not close. If anything, they persist and widen over time. However, we also have gone back into emergency shelters to try to figure out what are the early predictors of making a successful transition to school and achievement. And I've summarized the data I'm presenting for you in a handout with notes and also in a paper published just a few months ago that summarizes a lot of our research over the past 20 years. We find that good cognitive skills that you can measure by the time children are in preschool are very good predictors of how well they're going to do in school, and those skills are related to both the level of stress and adversity they've experienced and the quality of parenting that they experience. We particularly are interested in what are called executive function skills. You may have heard about these. These are the neurocognitive processes we all use to pay attention and plan and organize. And even in very young children, these develop rapidly and are crucial for making a good adjustment into the school years. These skills are related to brain development, and they also are malleable, which is why it's so important that children have opportunities early in development. Over the years in our research, we've seen many children in shelters, and we have seen many of them that were clearly way behind, and yet they had fallen through the cracks. They had never received any services, and they're about to enter school with a tremendous disadvantage. I think we've been missing an important developmental window. We know that, and I'm sure many of you are well aware, that there's a high return on early investment in quality early childhood programs. We know that from Nobel laureate Jim Heckman, the economist whose work you may know, and also from our own Art Rolnick and Arthur Reynolds, who've shown that in the state of Minnesota. So just to conclude, I want to say that our research has shown that there are large achievement gaps for homeless and other highly mobile children that emerge very early, and they're very persistent. Many of the homeless preschoolers we have done research with are clearly not ready for school, and many miss out on the early prevention and intervention services that would make a difference. We think that meeting the needs of homeless children early is a crucial piece of addressing the achievement gaps that we see when these children enter school, and is an important intervention opportunity. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Dr. Mastin. Members, I hope that you will read through her attachment, Educational Risk in Young Homeless Children, and what she's also given us with the child development perspectives. I've just been glancing through it as she testified, and it's very interesting and I think very relevant to the goal we're trying to achieve. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
My name is Sharon Henry Blythe. I am the director of the Visible Child Initiative, a program of the Family Housing Fund. I'm going to be very brief. I have the privilege of oftentimes working with parents of young children who are homeless. And I think it's important that it is pointed out that these are parents that are deeply committed to the health and well-being of their children. They have a vision for their children of being prosperous and educated and incredibly smart people in life. And so they're open to support. The early intervention services that are provided through Part C provide an incredible opportunity to work for parents to work with someone to ensure that the health and well-being, the development of their child is supported in a way that prepares them for school and prepares them for preschool. So I think I want to make a point that this is a population of parents that are open and ready and willing. They are totally dedicated to their children, and I believe the Part C program is an incredible opportunity to support them in their effort to raise their young children.
Thank you, Ms. Henry Blythe. Well said. And Representative Moran, I think I would like to move your finance amendment because we're sending this to K-12 finance, and I think we have a responsibility to attach this. So, members, I'm going to move the H-1428-A1 amendment. Is there any discussion? and maybe I can discuss it for you or just note what it says, Representative Moran. The department is to provide training on homelessness and its associated experiences, and there's an appropriation designated for 16 and 17, and then another directive to the department. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the A1 amendment is adopted. Some closing comments, Representative Moran, and thank you again to your testifiers. This is really important information for us to learn about our extensive homeless community, and I'm glad that Representative Dabney has provided us with that amendment to the omnibus bill so that we take a look at this.
Well, Madam Chair, I would like to thank you for hearing this bill this morning. And just want to close by saying that, you know, as Mrs. Flanagan stated, that there's 840 homeless infant and toddlers in our state, but only 8 were served by Part C last year. So granting these young children category eligibility for Part C services would raise the visibility of this often overlooked population and would improve child outcomes and reduce the need for costly future remedial services. So my hope is that we can support this, that we can make these invisible group of babies and toddlers visible, but also give them the services that they need so that they would become productive citizens, you know, early in life, in the middle of life, and in the end of life, not the end of life, but throughout their lives. So, again, I just want to thank you so much for the opportunity to bring this bill forward and using Part C as a way that they can get the services that they need. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Moran, for being innovative. And members, with that, I will renew Representative Moran's motion that 1428, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on K-12 Finance. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to K-12. We'll see you on Thursday, members. Thank you very much for your indulgence. The meeting is adjourned.